Cobra, Emperor, clone of a Mongol and a zombie dropped in the middle of a forgotten casino in the Gulf of Mexico in horror, grow to be the leader of a mutant superpower. And the world's going to know your name. What's your name? Genghis Khan. My name is Genghis Khan. And there's a million things I haven't killed. But just you eat, just you eat.
Onward to Springfield.
It's in Springfield, you can eat as a new man. In Springfield, you can eat as a new man. In Springfield, you can eat as a new man. In Springfield, just you eat.
I turned into a zombie for him.
I tomb raided for him.
I created him.
And I'm the downfall that shot him.
And there's a million different things I haven't killed. So just you eat. What's your name, man? Serpentor Khan.
Hey, 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 it's me, Mark, and welcome to Talking Joe. You're in the podcast where it all happens. If you are new to the show, you can find out all of the details over at the website, which is talkingjoe.co.uk. Today, we will be looking at G.I. Joe, A Real American Hero, issue 304, which was released on the 21st of February, 2024. And joining me, as always, it's my right-hand man, it's A Real American Tim, it's Tim Finn. How are you, sir?
I'm well. Hello, Mark, and hello, listeners.
Hello, Tim. Hey, Tim, yesterday I went to go and see Hamilton in the grand old big city of London with Thomas, and it was great.
Cool. I have not seen it, but I have seen a Broadway musical in London. I saw Wicked there 10 years ago, 12 years ago.
Oh, wow. No, that's been on my list of something that I probably should go and see at some point, but haven't got to. That is still going, just opposite Victoria Station.
There's a touring company, I'm sure, of Wicked. And it has been through Boston or will come back around. So I don't even go to New York, but I have been known to go to New York to see plays, not just musicals, but plays.
Mm.
But also there's a very fine theater. There are several fine theaters in Cambridge and Boston, very near where I live. And several hit Broadway shows started at the ART, at the American Repertory Theater, which is a mile and a half from me in Cambridge. So I don't have to go all the way to London to see the bestest stuff.
The bestest stuff. Excellent. So let's just touch on some news since the last episode where we talked about A Real American Hero. Just in the last week, there was a couple of announcements. The first was confirmation that April will indeed be a skip month. We won't have any Real American Hero coming out in April. And that will be followed by an issue 306 with a guest artist, Paul Pelletier. Or Pelletier? Pelletier? Pelletier, I'm going to say. Tim, what's your reaction to that news?
I am thrilled. He is one of a long list of artists who did wonderful work at Marvel and DC in the last 30 years, who I've always faintly, abstractly wondered, what would it take for this guy to draw G.I. Joe? Or, you know, what would it look like? And I can kind of imagine it. And I enjoyed his work on The Flash. I was not reading Negation at CrossGen, but I did flip through it now and then and thought, man, this guy's really coming into his own. And then he did a bunch of Marvel Cosmic stuff when CrossGen folded. And this is a great choice for a G.I. Joe fill-in. His stuff will look different than the issues so far from Skybound, but I'm really happy.
Yeah, it sort of seems like it skews slightly closer to that action adventure style, but with a bit of a modern injection in it, and a bit like a Dan Jurgens with a little bit, 15% extra detail. squeezed in.
Yeah, I think Juergens' stuff is a little more staid, a little more calm, a little less flashy. And Pelletier, I've always thought his stuff is a little more dynamic, a little warmer, like Alan Davis. And he definitely became closer to the like hot modern style of, you know, post Jim Lee comics when he was doing Aquaman at DC during the Geoff Johns run. Some of that I think was down to the inking, but I feel like there was an attempt to sort of line him up with Ivan Reis, who was drawing Justice League at the time, and those two books crossed over a year or two into the New 52. And so in my mind, there's still this sort of like, yeah, Dan Juergens, Mark Bright, Alan Davis, like more 70s, 80s sort of classic American adventure comics. I know Davis is British. In my mind, he's still doing that, but his stuff actually is more sort of modern and detailed. And based on the preview pages, it's going to be great.
Yeah, on the Skybound press release, they describe him as part cartoon, part realism in the grand tradition of Neil Adams and Alan Davis. So what did he have to say? He said, joining the G.I. Joe team sounded like a fun challenge. Having spent most of my career in the superhero world, G.I. Joe provides a chance for me to push myself as an artist and storyteller on a slightly different kind of book. Working with an all-time pro like Larry Hammer is a nice bonus, along with getting to work again with my friend Tony on inks and seeing page after page of Francesco's terrific colors. And he refers to Tony, that's Tony Cordos, the inker who's been announced. So this is all about issue 306, which will come out on May the 15th. So the other news that came out was about how well the book has been doing and an announcement of some additional printings. So issues 301, 302 and 303 all get further printings. So 301 is getting a third printing, a cover by Eduardo Panseca. 302 is getting a third printing as well, Ig Guara. And 303 is getting a second printing by Jacob Edgar. That one features Duke and on a motorbike and some Cobra Troopers. The 301 features Cobra Commander with a maggot. And what was the other one?
Jinx kicking.
That's right. And 302 was quite a dynamic one of Jinx kicking an alley viper.
I like all of these covers. I do wish that second print and third print covers related more to the story, to the interiors. And in some of these cases, these characters do show up. And so, you know, it fits. In other cases, it's a cool cover, but the character either isn't doing that in the issue or doesn't show up at all. And I start to feel the way that I do with sort of half of all covers and most variant covers, which is this might be a cool image, but this cover also could have been for any issue of G.I. Joe, you know? And when I think of my favorite covers of G.I. Joe, I mean, you know, certainly like issue one of G.I. Joe from 1982, that could be sort of any cover in the first year. So there's a small flaw in logic to this personal rule. But, you know, the cover to five with the Mobad in Central Park, you know, that cover wouldn't work for almost any other issue. And so if it's, you know, Jinx kicking someone, kicking anyone, is Jinx in the issue? What does she do? Does she use a certain weapon? Yeah. Is it at night?
Indeed. So yeah, it is that age-old problem of a cover not relating to the interior, and therefore there being that disconnect of like, okay, it's a nice image, but I won't for the life of me remember what issue it actually belongs to without some sort of guide in front of me. But, you know, beyond the new covers themselves, I guess the wider story is that as well as the Energon doing well and going to subsequent pre-printings and having a high sales numbers, That effect, it definitely is rubbing off on G.I. Joe, A Real American Hero 2, with the extra printings, I guess being a good signal that the book is doing well and being well received, and there being a demand, and as well as all of those IDW readers coming across, it's going to be picking up new and lapsed readers as well, which I guess is a large part of the move to having Skybound as a publisher.
One last bit. We can assume that the print runs of these new printings are smaller and probably much smaller than the first printing print runs, because the first printing print runs had variant covers. And so, you know, even for Real American Hero, where it's pretty locked down, you know, there isn't a 1 in 50 and a 1 in 100 and all that stuff. For Real American Hero, there's just been the 1 in 10. And then the black and white sort of open to order variant. There is this incentive for a store that was going to get, you know, 5 copies. Oh, well, we'll get 10, and then we can also get one of the 1 in 10 covers. Or if the ratio numbers are higher, you can expand that math upward with these open-to-order regular second prints, third prints. You know, a store that got 10, 50, 100 of the first print, this is a guess, but they're not going to get the same number. I know that my store is ordering a fraction of the second print. We're just sort of topping off to have a few more, or there are some subscribers who definitely want every cover, even if it's a few months later and it's a reprint. As a kid, I was sort of grumbled when a second print was worth more than the first print. And I first learned this weird lesson with Ghost Rider 15 from 1991. The second print also had a glow-in-the-dark cover. But the background color had changed. But someone said to me, well, it has a smaller print run. And I can't argue with that logic.
True. So let's move on past the news on to the detail of this issue. And here's the thing that I noticed, Tim. Looking at the credits page of the issue, which is a kind of salmony pink, would you call it? I can see now that the inside front cover, the colors that are being used there are to match to the cover. And I can see this for the first time, really, because in the previous three issues, the front cover and the first page cover had fairly sympathetic color schemes, whereas for this one, it is definitely that sort of pinky color tying to the sunset of the cover to the issue.
Yeah. Just a small design choice that makes each issue different, probably, from the previous and the next, and ties the whole package together. If you have a dominant color on the front cover, you carry that over to the back cover, you carry that over to the inside front cover. It doesn't say anything in particular. That one color doesn't mean anything. It's not happy, it's not sad, it's not good, it's not bad. It's just a decision. And you know, one of the hallmarks of comics design, really starting in the 90s when digital coloring and digital lettering, and then a studio like Comicraft, which wasn't just lettering but starting to do publication design, you know, you'd have very specific choices for how the credits were put into the inside front cover or the first page. You'd have very specific decisions about what design elements would go on the back cover, you know, or of a graphic novel. So yes, it's a nice touch here.
Yeah, and it does remind me that the back cover is not doing an awful lot. We've had this is the fourth issue now of a star in that similar color scheme to the front cover and the inside front cover. I'm going to make a note to myself in my next letter to my ARR back cover is Real Estate not being used to its full potential. Okay, so the creative team bringing this issue to us is writer Larry Harmer. Audience, I appreciate, I normally say Hammer because I'm English. We don't have the long A's so much. So I will sometimes try and remember and force myself to say Harmer. But there I am doing it there. Artist Chris Mooneyham. Colorist Francesco Segala. Flatter Sabrina Del Grosso. Letterer Pat Brousseau, editor Alex Antoni, publication design Gillian Crabb, and creative consultant Diana Davis. Tim, do you want to tell us about the covers of this issue?
Yeah.
Let's have a look at the covers in the gallery.
Cover A is by Andy Kubert, colored by Brad Anderson, and it's awesome. We are slightly looking up at three particular vipers. The camera is at chest height. It's a night creeper, not three vipers, a night viper and an alley viper. And they're all in different poses and they're all on guard, sort of patrolling around what I think is a hiss tank. But above them and behind them is Don Marino in costume, standing at the ready with both swords drawn. There's a nice bit of contrapposto on her pose, a little bit of spine twist. Her weight is slightly shifted more onto one leg than the other. And there are a bunch of nice sort of diagonals and lines that cross each other as elements here between the Night Creeper's insane quintuple crossbow, which we could go back in time to 1990 and talk about, Dawn's sheaths, her actual swords, her arms, and then the two turrets on the hiss tank. There is a knocked back in the colors, bit of sort of atmospheric inking in the sky behind the logo and the characters and the vehicle, where Kubert has inked in a bunch of diagonal lines as if, you know, the wind is blowing. There's also a little bit of smoke or mist to slightly separate the three foreground characters from Dawn, who's in the middle ground. The three villains down on the bottom are lit from the side on the right by a little bit of light blue, and also slightly underlit on the front and the left with, I'm not quite sure the color, it might just be sort of a neutral white light. But this cover is so awesome, Mark, because it's filled with tension. It has sort of a badass pose on the Joes, a great sense of menace and danger on the Cobras. It does have a bit of vehicle, even though it's not a vehicle cover. Kubert nails the details and the specificity of these three Cobras. He doesn't make anything up. He doesn't add anything. Maybe he adds a little bit on the Viper's helmet, but I'm totally, the Night Viper's helmet. I'm totally okay with it. All their poses are really different. They are cropped and also obstructing each other, and yet there's still enough real estate on each of their costumes that I can see a bunch of details that I like the blue camo on the Alley Viper, like the sort of shoulder wrapping on the Night Creeper, the very specific helmet bits on the Night Viper. Each of them is a different color, green, purple, orange. What I also like about this cover, as with the previous covers, is that Kubert can draw tension. His anatomy is superb. He also can slightly exaggerate things. He's putting some forced perspective on the Night Creeper's crossbow, where the points of the arrows are really, really close to us and much bigger than they actually would be. And then he's playing a little bit with that, with the Night Creeper's hands and head. It's a little bit like a fisheye lens, a little bit like looking through a peephole in a door, but it doesn't make the cover weird. It's not doing any sort of circular perspective warping to everything else. And the colors are gorgeous. this cover is totally great. I'm so glad Andy Kubert, like I said before, he's not just a good artist. It's not just a good comics artist. He's an excellent cover artist. And there are lots of people who draw really good sequential panels and pages and even splash pages who don't make the most exciting covers. And then there are certainly people who can do covers but aren't sort of fast enough or don't want to take the pay cut to do a lot of interiors. And Andy Kubert does both and does both really well. And so he's the total package. Man, look at the Night Creeper's hands. Look at the fingers and the veins on the hand on the right. Ah.
On cover A, I did have a thought just when I was looking at this, and I was just thinking to myself, for purposes of symmetry, would it have worked better if the Alley Viper on the right was facing to the right? Thoughts, Tim?
Yes. I think that would make the cover also good in a different way. I don't know that it would improve the cover. I don't know that there's anything wrong with having those two Vipers both aiming to the left. I think if anything, it slightly suggests, even though Dawn is centered behind them, I think it slightly suggests that they're walking a little bit toward us and a little bit to the left. And we're sort of cheating where she's behind them and a little bit to the right of them. So they're missing her. I think that's a bit of the story here. But also, if the Alley Viper were flopped, which is the technical term for mirroring something in Photoshop, his weapon might get cropped at the right edge of the cover.
True. Yeah, because he's working sort of up the diagonal that's been created on the Alley Viper. Yeah, it might be harder to pull that one off. Okay.
Cover B, I just want to be precise here. I'm looking, I forgot to bring a copy home from my store, so I'm looking at a JPEG on my computer rather than holding the book, and I'm fairly positive that this will be accurate for the printed copy. But the B cover is black and white. It's just Kubert's inks. There's no color. And the version I'm looking at is the original scan of Kubert's color without the regular amount of levels and full, this is a Photoshop term, threshold adjustment, where dark grays are turned into complete black and light grays are turned into complete white. And what I see here is definitely a black and white cover. But if you look at all the inking in the black of Dawn's costume and the hiss tank, you see where ink is being piled on. You see brush strokes, which is going to be turned into an absolute black for the, you know, color version. But as a small contrast with the black and white variants for 301, 302, and 303, those were printed in black and white with just white and black and not sort of splotchy inking original art black.
Yeah, this is closer to like an artist edition kind of reprint where you can see some of the...
Yeah, the variations in the inking. But the whites here are all still like pure white. This is not like a lot of those artist editions of art from the 60s where, you know, there's like coffee rings and blue yeah. pencil and white out all over the white. Yeah, yeah. It's not that. This is white and, you know, dark, 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 dark black, but not, you know, night sky black. And then cover C is yet another really lovely Brad Walker and Francesco Sagala 1 in 10 variant. This time it's Duke in the foreground, slightly below his waist up. He's got a pistol and the signature machine gun from the first 2 years of the cartoon. There are some explosions behind him and then looming in the distance, leaning down at us, teeth clenched, brow furrowed, fist also clenched is Destro, just his head and a bit of his shoulders and, oh, both fists. You can see a little bit of his red jewel swinging in some negative space below Duke's arm. Two nice big bright bits of chrome shine at the very top of the image for the top of Destro's helmet. I love Brad Walker's three previous covers more than this one. There's nothing wrong with this one. I think just sort of the poses and the differences in color jump out at me a little more on the previous three. This is still a wonderful cover, a very cool variant cover, a great use of just cool guy and just mean guy looking awesome or menacing. And Brad Walker, if he wants to do more covers or all interiors, totally welcome in my book.
We've seen the solicits now for May, so know that Brad Walker's variant covers continue on to at least issue 306 in this same sort of style, Joe in the foreground and a cobra in the background. So yeah, we've got at least six issues and we'll see how much longer beyond that he'll continue.
Yes. Actually, since I talked for so long about the covers, since the regular cover is so awesome, Mark, do you agree with me that the regular cover is not just awesome, but extra awesome?
That's true. True story. And for completeness, we have a Snake Eyes cover from Mike Mayhew as an exclusive. He has also revealed his ARA 305 exclusive, which will go on sale very shortly, which features Storm Shadow. Clayton Crane also has a exclusive cover again of Snake Eyes, featuring a torso, a small full figure of him kneeling down, and a headshot all in one with an Arashikage tattoo symbol in there in the mix as well. And this apparently is going to be limited to 200 copies, which will be going live on Saturday, the 24th of February. So very hard to find, I imagine. This one was very late in being revealed, a couple of days after the regular book came out.
Plot breakdown.
In Dr. Mindbender's lab on Cobra Island, Mindbender, Serpentor Khan, and Alpha 001 are happy with the Blue Ninja attack on Snake Eye's cabin that appears to have resulted in his and Scarlet's deaths. The Cobras make plans to enhance more mutated troopers and casino guests. Meanwhile, in the Sierras, we find out that we, the audience, were definitely fooled by the death in the previous issue, as it is revealed that using tomato sauce for blood, that Scarlet and Snake Eyes were only pretending to have died. So that month in mourning was wasted energy. A G.I. Joe cleanup crew of Black Cat, Mainframe, and Airtight arrive by Tomahawk to collect Blue Ninja remains. Snake Eyes needs to get dressed and opens a trunk containing a familiar mask with a visor. And as the Joes fly back with the scraps, the Blue Ninjas reactivate, causing some mid-air pandemonium before the Joes are able to quell that robot rebellion. In Springfield, Dawn sneaks out from her parents' house for some reconnaissance. She passes maggot tanks and discovers a trio of enhanced mutant vipers from Cobra Island, a night viper, an alley viper, and a night creeper, who are on their own recon mission. They spy on Cobra Commander in the community center auditorium as he outlines his plan to launch a counteroffensive on the soon-to-be invading mutant zombie forces. But he divides real and false plans. They spot Dawn snooping on them and they launch an attack. As it becomes evident that they will not succeed, they initiate a self-destruct countdown. Meanwhile, at the pit, the Joes are keeping tracks on another enhanced Viper trio on a recon trip to investigate Camp Greer on the surface above the pit. But the Vipers only find a trio of empty Quonset huts. Finally, in a castle in Scotland, Zartan visits Destro and the Baroness with news of recent events and proposes to put aside their differences and work together. ... To be continued. Tim, what was your overall reaction to this one?
This issue was awesome, and artist Chris Mooneyham really eased off on the straight-on, one-point perspective, boring shots that I was calling out in our last Real American Hero episode of Talking Joe. I was really pleased with everything about this story, and particularly the letters page, for two reasons, but I think we'll get to that later, won't we?
Okay.
Mark.
Sure.
Yeah, I don't know if, I mean, you know, the letter that I wrote 4 weeks ago certainly got to the Skybound, you know, offices weeks and weeks and weeks after Mooneyham drew this issue. So I cannot think that my comment, and I encouraged a friend who's not you, Mark, to write a similar and shorter email echoing the same sentiment. Those had nothing to do with this. But I do wonder if some other people, independent of me and this podcast, who read the first issue back, the second issue back, the third issue back, did catch that same, what I consider, storytelling weakness and mention it in letters. Or maybe if readers didn't point it out, maybe someone in the Skybound team did see it, or maybe at Hasbro, and encouraged Mooneyham to add a little variety to his, quote, camera placement. There are still some straight-on shots here, but a couple of them, he is slightly tilting, if not the camera up or down. He's turning the characters a little bit up, a little bit left, a little bit right. And so even that small change, even those small changes make a lot of difference. I also appreciated how many different characters showed up in this issue.
Mm, true.
The color continues to be really wonderful, sort of limited, but at the same time, quite rich. And there's a lot of good action in this issue. And there have been episodes of the show in the last couple of years where you and I have read an issue and we've said, this is good. This feels like a transition issue. Or this issue is good. It's repeating a couple beats from the previous issue. And I didn't feel like that at all for this one. This one felt like a lot happens. Each subplot gets moved forward. And there are a couple fun surprises in it. I have sort of, you know, I have a couple, you know, I wish this would have been done a little differently, but awesome issue.
Cool. That's very heartening to hear that reaction, Tim. Yeah, I think it is a different feel for the issue than a lot of the others. It I guess previously we've had a lot of establishing of components, and this one is feels more like it's moving things along, and we're seeing bits of each subplot a couple of pages at a time without lingering too long on any single piece. And I guess there's more locations, there's more movement, there's a bit more action, and possibly that is sort of all coming together to contribute to kind of a slight change in how the artist approaches some of those things, as well as beyond anything else. How should we do this, Tim? I've got less kind of overarching ideas about this. So we could perhaps sort of like, you know, do a little bit of a walkthrough and sort of just see what comes to mind as we sort of go through.
Page one, do you have 303, the previous issue, near you, Mark?
I've got it behind me, I think.
The three villains are looking at a computer screen, and I'm wondering if what they see is a repeat of art we saw at the end of the previous issue, which I don't love, but it's also fair, particularly if they were seeing something on a computer screen. If Moodyham redrew it, I totally appreciate that.
I am 95% confident that panel that appears on the computer screen is the same as the last panel in the previous issue. And yes, it is.
All right.
Although that was also positioned as a frame on their feed, so it kind of makes sense that there's a repeat of that for Storio, for story purposes as well.
And Mooneyham here seemingly has, if he's working in Photoshop, used the distort or skew or perspective tool to turn what was a square or rectangle into a bit of a trapezoid.
Hmm.
So previous episode, I was talking about Mooneyham drawing a lot of one-point perspective where we're looking straight down a hallway, straight at a wall, straight at the front or side of a building, and there being no diagonals for the tops of doors, the tops of where the wall meets the ceiling, where the wall meets the floor. Look at panel one of this issue. This is two-point perspective. So we are not perpendicular to that wall that says Lab 1 on the door or the two computer screens. Now, Mooneyham does go to a one-point perspective on the panel below, but the camera is slightly lower than all three characters. You know, we can't really see the bottom of Serpentor Khan's chin and jaw, or Mindbender's for that matter. But by putting the camera a little bit lower, he's adding a little bit of oomph to this page. Yes, turn the page. Page two. Yes, the establishing shot of the cabin in the woods, and then the two corpses and the debris and all the smoke. Those are straight on shots. I think for an establishing shot, that's okay. And there's also enough sort of going on in compositional arrangement on that second panel. Snake Eyes is interesting pose. Scarlet's interesting pose. The foreground element that's knocked out in maroon.
Yeah,
of the beam with some throwing stars and gashes in it. There's enough going on that I don't look at this and think, boring straight on shot. I think, okay, straight on shot with a lot going on.
I spy with my little eye.
There was an I spy and an error detected on this page. So let's start with the error detected. Tim, over to you because you spotted this.
Oh, yeah. First of three typos in this issue. Page 2, panel 3, Scarlet says, "Stop that, Timber. All that sugar in meatball, the tomato sauce, MRE, isn't good for you." And there appeared to be a word or two missing, or a word that needs to move in placement in that word balloon. Somewhere in the, you know, script going from writer to editor, from editor to letterer, from letterer to back to editor, something got deleted here. It still makes, you can figure it out, but it's always a little sad. You know, this kind of thing, if this happened in a Marvel book, I think what actually would have happened is someone would catch it, and then this word balloon would be in a slightly different handwriting than the rest of the entire issue as someone else in the bullpen fixes it last minute. You can see that in all sorts of 80s and early 90s Marvel books.
Yeah.
So there's the error detected for page 2. What's your I spy?
So this speech bubble probably was meant to say something like, all that sugar in the meatball and tomato sauce MRE isn't good for you. So my I spy was MRE, both in that speech bubble, but also on the packet that is being held by Snake Eyes. And so a good point to call out, what is an MRE?
It's a meal ready to eat. And it's interesting that this didn't get a footnote on this page. If this were Marvel issue 20 or 70, there definitely would be a footnote where this acronym gets spelled out. But, you know, after decades of G.I. Joe comics and news stories about the military, TV shows, movies, we know what it is.
And for those not in the know, MRE stands for Meal Ready to Eat. It's a self-contained individual United States military ration used by the United States Armed Forces and Department of Defense. It's intended for use by American service members in combat or field conditions where other food is not available. MREs have also been distributed to civilians as humanitarian daily rations, such as natural disasters and wars. And I think they used to get a bad rap. I don't know if that's quite still the case, but I guess the intent behind them is to have something that keeps you going in the field and will last a long time and is quite rugged rather than necessarily particularly delicious. I did do a Google search for this one, and it turned up as MRE menu number 8, meatballs in marinara sauce. So I think it is a thing that does exist. Tim, have you ever tried one?
No, but I my hometown had an Army Navy surplus store, and they sold a few, so I saw some packages for them. Oh, and I think I was at a gun store a couple years ago, and they were also selling them there. But I think Larry Hama in G.I. Joe comics in the last 5 or 10 years has made a comment that where a character in the story notes that sort of they're better than they used to be. That sort of rings a bell. Okay, three things are happening on this page of note. One, Hama is telling a joke in Timber, tipping the reveal of how these Joes survived the cliffhanger from last issue. And, you know, G.I. Joe isn't a funny book, so when a character tells a small joke or there's a small situational bit of humor, I notice it. Two, the Joes did survive. They weren't slaughtered at the end of last issue. And I feel a little embarrassed that I didn't guess that this was a possibility. I was pretty certain they weren't dead, but I really didn't know how. And three, Snake Eyes talks again, but notably very little.
Snake Eyes talking, Snake Eyes talk.
talking about things he wants to say.
Scarlett asks him a question, and his response is, uh-huh. And I also realized, starting on this page, in both of the panels in which Snake Eyes appears, his face is in shadow or mostly in shadow. Mm-hmm. And Mooneyham does this all through the issue, or has him turn away from the, quote, camera. And I think, even though this Snake Eyes has no scars on his face, although maybe we're not entirely sure, I think logic suggests he does not. I think Mooneyham is continuing the convention that we don't mm-hmm. get to see Snake Eyes' face. Only characters in the story do. And I think that's cool. I think that's proper. And then similarly, he can talk, but Hama is seemingly having him not talk much.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the ratio of words coming out of Scarlet's mouth versus Snake Eyes, it's got to be a factor of 20, or at least.
Yeah.
He's got one more word in this whole issue, which is where he just says, right.
Yeah, he agrees with her. And then on the next page, a couple cool things happen. A Joe shows up who we haven't seen in a long time, and another Joe shows up who we haven't seen in a little while, but who never gets to go into the field. We see Airtight and Mainframe. And we also see Black Hat, who I must admit I had sort of forgotten about amongst the five or so new Joes that got introduced a year before the end of the IDW run. And then Snake Eyes gets to do two cool things. He pulls his sword out of a blue ninja, and he opens up a footlocker and sees what looks like his version 2 costume, or at least part of it. And that's just cool. In the letters page, the editor, Alex Anton, suggests that there's a little meaning behind that scene.
Yeah, so I guess the hint is that by Snake Eyes opening this chest and finding his V2 costume with the visor, he's going to be wearing that, and that's going to be at least one way that will differentiate this Snake Eyes from the Throwdown character, although, you know, he potentially is going to change his look as well, so we'll have to see on that
one. Yeah, I think we'll get a version 2 with a lot of changes, but yeah
so I think Snake Eyes during a lot of the IDW run was wearing that sort of visor look to him, and when he died, generally Throwdown was kind of wearing a sort of more commando type mask, so we've not seen that visor in the best part of 100 issues, I guess.
Yeah, and Throwdown's new and improved costume got a bunch of callouts in its debut issue. There were like some little bits on the sides of it where it was like communications, and it was the kind of subtle thing that sometimes artists drew well, and sometimes just looked like his head was slightly misshapen.
And then, so we've got Airtight back after not appearing for quite some considerable time, and I think a few of us have speculated that with all of this mutant zombie bomb and the, you know, potential toxins and all the rest of it, that will we see a bit more? Is he a character that could potentially appear? So it's quite cool that he has, and that we're seeing those sort of specialities being used of sort of airborne toxins, etc., and also then the sort of hardware software issues around the blue ninjas.
Yeah, this page here, page 3, is another, I know I come back to this idea a lot, but I think it bears continuous repeating. There's no comic book like G.I. Joe, because you have not just a vehicle, but a very specific vehicle that is someone's favorite toy. Right, so you have the tomahawk. So Mooneyham has to not just show it in action landing, but he gets to show it in a really nice sort of presentational panel. It's like, here it is. It's landed. There isn't anything in the way. It's not on fire. There aren't like missiles aiming toward it. And then there are a bunch of Joes just sort of overlapping and going about their business, you know, cleaning up this site and talking to each other. And then, just as the page starts with a focus on the I don't say this as a negative. I say this as what it is. As a toyetic comic book, the final panel bookends that, right? It's like, remember this guy's really cool costume that we haven't seen in a while? Here it is. and this is a satisfying page in terms of, you know, units of story and also like presenting the brand and also, you know, some new, some old. And you know, there's not a lot of action. You know, helicopter lands, guys carry in some stuff, people talk.
Yeah. 8 panels on this page as well, which is, you know, just flicking through. It's a chock full issue that most pages do have minimum 3, maximum of about 8.
Yeah. Panels.
So there's a lot being crammed in.
This is a good point that Larry Hama G.I. Joe compared to a lot of other comics being published in the 2020s, because it's a team book, not a solo book, and because Hama writes in an old-fashioned way, that's sort of his words, and also that's, I don't see that as a negative. You know, he's not writing for, quote, the trade, a trade paperback collection, and he knows he's juggling a bunch of plots and sets of characters and locations. And I think in addition to that sort of introductory thing where I said a bunch of subplots here and they all move forward, I think this is an issue where a bunch is happening on every page. And that's a good challenge for Mooneyham. You know, it's like, just look at the next page where, you know, like a suburban house, a suburban home, living room. This panel where Dawn is putting on her costume and zipping up her costume and holding her helmet, you know, think of superhero comics. I can imagine that panel would be twice as big in some other version of this story. You know, it's like, oh, gotta be able to sell the art, that cool new ninja who's not quite Snake Eyes suiting up, you know, or like, gotta make this sort of more like a cover, or like, gotta make this sexy. And even though that panel is a little bigger than 3 of the other panels on this page, it is not the most important, right? All of the panels in this page are about equally important. And, you know, you could argue that sort of for like tension, the middle panel is actually the most important, where her parents are worrying. And then something really interesting happens on this page and the next page. And I didn't even realize it until I was a couple panels in.
Mm.
There is an internal monologue. There are not thought balloons, but captions with a character's first-person thoughts. On these two pages, there are a whole bunch of orange boxes, and it's Dawn thinking to herself for our benefit. And I cannot think of when Hama has done this in a G.I. Joe comic, right? He wrote Wolverine this way, but G.I. Joe tends not to have a main character. And I'm sure there have been thought balloons. I can't remember any specifically, but
very few thought balloons. Very, very few.
Yeah, but this two-page scene where Dawn is thinking to herself as captioned narrator, everything that she thinks is interesting and helpful and pushes the story forward. But this is a remarkable departure, not for Larry Hama, but for Larry Hama on G.I. Joe. And, you know, she starts by saying, "Mom and Pop are still loyal Cobras." So I have to do my little recce on the sly, my reconnaissance. And she's picking up from what they've just said, and sort of either she can hear them or she knows they're expressing this concern. They're worried they're going to be found out that they're hiding her.
Can I just point out something from this page? That panel of Dawn sort of zipping up her top did make me sort of just pause and go, has Dawn's uniform been redesigned here?
Oh, yeah.
And I did have to go back and look. And,
she's got that. Check. She's got that Jim Lee Cyclops belt buckle that's gone from her upper torso, right?
Yeah. So it's not really a wholesale redesign, but they've got rid of those sort of the double strap bandolier type thing that sort of, yeah, the Jim Lee Cyclops straps that are seen on the front cover. That's missing from her costume. So it's a small touch, but it sort of makes the costume look a little bit more practical. more like a kind of a thick leather tunic rather than perhaps something more superhero-y.
Yeah. So on the next page, panels 2 and 3, you know, panel 2. Hey, there's some three-point perspective. We are looking down. We're on a high rooftop, or we're floating, looking down at the community center. And then the panel after it, I guess technically it's one-point perspective, but it's reading like two-point perspective because of how Dawn's running past the tanks. And then I thought, oh, cool, maggots. Mm. This week we got a double dose of maggots because Cobra Commander is in front of a maggot on one of the reprints. Is it the 301 third print cover?
Yeah.
And I am always happy for Hama in his plots to call out a specific sort of different or later vehicle. I'm always happy for artists to, if Hama's plot doesn't specify or just make the change, it's like, no, it doesn't have to just be his tanks. It could be, you know, rage tanks. It could be maggots. You know, the maggot is not my favorite vehicle. And it's not my favorite Cobra tank. That's the Hiss, because the Hiss is so elegant. Wayne Luther, Hasbro, 1982. But I'm always sad when artists or Hama are just remembering, you know, the first 4 years of vehicles, because there is so much variety and color and spice. And then at the bottom of this page, the very three Vipers from the front cover show up. Mm-hmm. And so remind me, Mark, these three Vipers did not, Night Creeper and two Vipers. These three specific Cobra agents, did they show up at the end of last issue as any kind of little sort of patrol?
I don't believe so. I think this is the first we see of them.
Okay.
Yeah.
So this kind of specific connection between the cover and the interior, and the cover is a little bit of an exaggeration because that exact scene doesn't happen where Dawn's on a tank behind these three guys, but close enough, this feels very much like reading a G.I. Joe comic and a lot of Marvel and DC comics in the 80s. And this isn't just, you know, Batman on a gargoyle or like Spider-Man swinging through the city or Spider-Man swinging in front of a blank background, you know, or like, it's like, the Wolverine art appreciation cover where it's like a painting of Wolverine in the style of Van Gogh and it's actually like a Deadpool variant. It's like, no. This, the thing that got me excited about the cover, I get a little bit of closure on it because it happens in the issue. And so the cover and the issue become more and properly entwined in my mind.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, I'd be excited if the cover was just a really cool image of Dawn crouching on a Hiss tank, a la Batman crouching on a gargoyle.
And we get a reminder as well that these aren't just sort of normal Cobras with the dialogue. The Night Viper here is saying, those Viper guards up there look mighty tasty and my stomach is growling. we're being reminded as well that they are actually these zombies with a little bit of taste for forbidden flesh.
So a tiny contrast gets set up on this page in the same panel where I think, awesome, a Night Creeper, I love them. Purple and magenta and an Alley Viper and a Night Viper. It's like two of my favorite Vipers and that awesome Cobra Ninja. So I'm going to put a pin in that, a little comparison for later. On the next page, we get something a little different. We get Spirit at the main underground pit computer monitor chair, and Duke is still there, and you know, some other Joes are still there, but usually we see Spirit outside in one of the Quonset huts or, you know, nearby looking down at the Quonset huts. But Mainframe is on this mission cleaning up the Blue Ninjas in the Sierras, and so that's a fun little difference. And then on this page where, you know, we cut back to the pit and we're underground and Spirit's sitting there, all the dialogue that's happening here, I appreciate it because it's half the characters sort of reminding you what has happened in the last issue, which is something that Hama does, just sort of how he writes, because he's writing issue to issue. He's not thinking so much of a, you know, graphic novel where you're going to read these pages and then a moment later the next pages for the next issue. But also Hama is having the characters sort of catch themselves up. It's not just for our benefit. It's like some of the Joes know that something has changed. And now more of the Joes know that something has changed, right? It's like, oh, remember, Dawn's there. Or, oh, Serpentor Khan and Alpha 001 must have made a deal. And I appreciate that kind of sort of the mechanics of who knows what getting slightly updated as the story goes. And then at the bottom of the page, there's just a very handsomely drawn, very Chris Mooneyham face. You still have some of that Geo Kubert, Andy Kubert, Lee Weeks, Jordy Brunet look, but like this one panel of Duke, you know, with like a really nice core shadow on the right side of his head, and then there's that like gash of white separating his cheek from his ear, and that's the reflected light. You know, Mooneyham hasn't done a ton of close-ups because usually there are a bunch of characters in a panel or a vehicle. And I sort of stopped with this panel and thought, yeah, there's Duke. What a good-looking drawing. What a... It's like this is the most Chris Mooneyham panel of the four issues.
On this same page as well, we get the introduction of something new, which is Dawn clicking on her headset and a little message pops up saying, "This is Betty. How can I help you?" "Betty, open a secure encrypted channel to the pit." Betty is the AI virtual assistant in G.I. Joe comms.
And this has never been introduced before, right? This is not
No, this is new.
This is not a thing from like issue 280 and I forgot.
No, we've had an AI Betty, which was Betty the casino bot, which I remember as being a clever pun because, you know, casino Betty. So it's a recycling of the name Betty in the period of a few issues, but the concept of Betty being the G.I. Joe AI is a new one. So I guess the equivalent of their, I'm going to have to say this quietly, Alexa or Siri.
There's, I think it's funny that Hama just drops it. He just drops it in the story. And you know, usually this is the kind of thing where like, 2 pages earlier, I feel like there'd be some Joes like crawling up a hill and talking about Betty. It's like,
yeah,
since we got this new Joe com AI, that's right, Stalker. Like, let me try this out. Like, sneak peek back at base. It's like coming in loud and clear. It's like Betty works.
Yeah. Say, psych out. It's sure will be great for Dawn to be trialing the new Betty AI on this first mission. That's right, mainframe. Let's see how successful.
I think Hama has no time for that. Mm. Something else small happens on this page. The word balloon that is at the top of the page that's floating over the Quonset huts and points into the ground. There's a little star shape at the bottom of the tail, which is the word balloon visual when someone is like behind a closed door or on the other side of a window, and either you can't hear them properly because you're separated by something, or as sort of a third person omniscient audience, you can hear them even though in the logic of the scene we're still above ground and you wouldn't hear them, right? It's like in a movie, this is an L cut where, you know, we're seeing the visual of the current shot, but we're starting to hear the audio of the next shot, which is underground in the base, and Spirit continues his line.
Yeah, Spirit is kind of on the at the desk, as you've mentioned, and part of that is because of his role as being kind of in charge of the pit security.
Yeah,
and so they're aware of these three Vipers sort of on the perimeter, and so I guess Spirit is a bit more front and center at the desk than he would normally be. Not just because Mainframe's not there, but also because of his role as pit defense and
but this little tracking, this little tiny bit of white on that top panel where the word balloon doesn't just point to the ground but points to the ground and sort of sticks into it the same way that if you drew a character like tapping on a window, you might draw three little lines by their index finger. That's a small lettering visual that I have always appreciated. Okay, so next page, now I'm going to come back to that thing that I stuck a pin in. Hama and Mooneyham are so specific with a Night Creeper, an Alley Viper, and a Night Viper on a previous page. And now we get this bit continued from the previous issue, where it definitely looks like an 86 Viper and 86 Viper and a new made up character, and they're identified specifically as a Viper, okay, a Techno Viper, I don't see one of those, and a Toxo Viper. And I think we talked about in the previous episode, the previous issue, Mooneyham was basically designing a new sort of beefed up, like mutated Toxo Viper. And that's cool. We don't get to sort of see it clearly enough for me to enjoy it. So even though it happened, I still don't quite believe it happened. Toxo Viper 3, I guess, version 3.
Mm.
But I am a little sad that at the bottom of the page, on the left or on the right, that just looks like 286 Vipers, and I really want one of them to be purple and with that very particular Techno Viper helmet. And it's not even like they made a mistake and I don't like it when comics make mistakes. It's that I love the specificity of different G.I. Joe designs, and in the same way that, like, in a battle scene, you know, an artist could draw three Hiss tanks, or they could draw two Hiss tanks and a maggot, and I'd think, cool, mm-hmm. more variety. Because that's, you know, G.I. Joe was different every year as the toys were coming out. So in that regard, this page made me a little sad. And we do get the big panel here of the four Joes looking a little past us at the computer monitor. We do get one of these straight on shots, which, you know, this issue moves very much away from. But I will note all four of the Joes are slightly sort of twisting their waists or torsos a little bit off axis. So even though the camera is looking straight at them and the wall behind them, they're not quite straight at us.
And there's, I guess, two sensible explanations as to why we're getting these sort of the look of the Viper isn't quite matching the description of them, which is, well, I guess maybe three reasons. They kind of no prize it on the page, saying that they're Revanche enhanced versions, and that's why they can't quite ID them. The other one would be that Chris Mooneyham didn't quite realize that the character descriptions of these Vipers at the time, that he thought that a Toxo Viper and a Techno Viper are just the same as a normal Viper, but with a different speciality, but look the same. Or the third option could be that maybe it wasn't called out in the script and it's a bit of a retconning of, okay, we need these different specialities, so let's change it in the lettering pass rather than the final one.
Yes, but, I'm pinning this on Mooneyham. It's possible that Hama's plot wasn't specific and then his script did call out more specificity. There's a fourth option that on Cobra Island, where all these zombies are, you know, their clothes are torn as they're mutated and they're fighting each other and eating people who were gambling. And then, you know, Serpentor Khan says, "You three, you're going on a reconnaissance mission. Get some clothes." Yeah. And a Techno Viper grabs whatever's handy. In which case, this is where I'm really nitpicking. I would love it if he's got, let's say, the Viper helmet, but the Techno Viper gloves, black gloves, not red gloves.
So they look through the window of these Quonset huts, these three Vipers. One is made out of straw, one is made out of wood. And, no, wait, I'm getting confused. No, one is too hot, one is too cold, and one is just right. No, wait. They're all empty. So they seem to be giving up the scene doesn't completely sort of, you know, resolve this, what's going on, what the next step is for these Vipers. But they seem to just, you know, conclude that there's nothing there. And Spirit on that final panel, we've got this close-up of him going, heh, heh. And I thought to myself, that's a little bit strange. It seems a bit out of character of Spirit. But is he sort of just, you know, having that little laugh of congratulations that they seem to have fooled the Vipers, that they're looking in and it's empty, or is there something else going on?
I might be falling too much into tropes I see in TV and movies, where, like, they're going to walk in and the one that has the rug actually has a bomb, and Spirit knows that and we don't. So it's like irony, where a character knows something that we don't. That's sort of where I thought this was going. Like, he knows they're walking into a trap. But yes, it didn't strike me as out of character. Although, you know, I don't know that we've seen Spirit sort of smile or lightly crack jokes, but I guess there are a lot of Joes that we haven't seen smile. And I do want to be aware of not falling into the stereotype of the Native American Joe who's like extra spiritual, has a sixth sense, is very serious, as he was somewhat portrayed on the cartoon. You know, he can have a sense of humor, he can be sad, just like other Joes can. And so if we have only seen him sort of serious up until now, and here he's enjoying himself, rather than feeling sort of out of character, I feel like Hama has gotten a little more interested in the sort of second half of this whole run across several decades in getting us a little more into the heads of the characters. And I, and as a reminder, I don't remember how many issues it was. Was it in the 220s? Spirit talks to another Joe about being adopted?
Something like that. We see there might have been some dialogue, but there was also a visit home to Spirit's
adopted parents.
Yeah,
with another Joe. And so this bit here feels like, okay, this isn't quite a look into his inner life, but this is a little bit more than just sort of the business of being a brave soldier. This page... Go for it.
I was going to say, this scene, though, I think it's not necessarily going to go anywhere, because a couple of pages later, there's a Televiper updating Serpent, or, and he briefs him. He says, the team at the pit believes there is more to the three empty Quonset huts than they found, than what is obvious. They are investigating further and tell them to call back when they have something concrete. Actually, yeah. Through to the spring. Oh, actually, I'm reading this again. Tell them to call back when they have something concrete. I originally read that as him telling them to come back, but so he's saying keep on investigating and let us know when you have something concrete. So maybe this thread will continue, that they'll continue to sort of try and find out what's going on there. I thought maybe this wasn't going to go anywhere, but maybe it will.
And I think as Hama wrote this page, he didn't know where it might go. This page also, it's not a very sexy page. You know, it's a bunch of sort of far away shots and sort of not boring interiors, but boring interiors. And the sort of most exciting, if you're like collecting original art, and I think Mooneyham draws digitally, so there's no original art. But if you're collecting original art, you know, well, Spirit shows up. Oh, well, it's the lower third of his mouth, of his head and his neck. But in terms of storytelling, this page is striking to me because I can see the specificity that Hama is calling out in, I can see the plot of Hama's plot through the final page here. And in the hands of an artist who's not great at storytelling, this page would not come out in a satisfying way. And like, notice in the first panel, there's three Quonset huts, and very clearly each of these three cobras is running up to one each to the door in the center. And the third cobra basically has his back to that wall as if he's going to like turn around and peek in or turn around and kick down the door. And then we get these three little inset panels, reverse angle of them peering in sort of at us. And then the reverse angles of those, what they see as they look in through those door windows. And then sort of just above Spirit's hair on the right side, it's actually a continuation of the top panel. And then you get this very horizontal panel that focuses just on his mouth, which adds a little emphasis to the ha-ha, right? That would be a little less sort of impish if we could see his whole face. It's like, we can't see his face, we just see the smile. And this page is not, you know, complex compared to, I don't know, like, you know, infiltrating Cobra Island, or like doing some very specific stuff with like a very specific, you remember we were talking about, who were we talking with? It was like around issue 285, and we had a guest, and we were talking about that scene in the IDW run when like there's some Joes and there's some characters and there's a car and a garage and there's an ambush, and it's like, which character is on which side of the door and which door is open and who's shooting at who. And the artist was saying, Was it?
This must be S.L. Gallant for the issue that he did for Murder by Assassination.
Okay. You know, the different kinds of characters moving around in space, fight scenes, have different levels of complexity. And I'm not saying that this is like the most complex page on the of the issue, but I can see if I was, you know, 14 years old and really wanting to break into comics, if someone gave me the plot for this page and said, lay this out, I'd say, well, that's boring. And then I'd do a bad job. And so this page is sort of deceptively advanced, sort of deceptively simple. It's like deceptively important. Because Mooneyham has to get all this information right. And he manages to do it with some panache. You know, it's not a standard 6-panel grid or 9-panel grid. So as I got to this page, I thought, all right, in addition to fewer of those straight-on boring shots, there's also a page like this where there's actually a lot going on.
You mentioned that you thought that Mooneyham is working digitally. I don't know necessarily that he is. I've seen a couple of pages that were put up via his art rep Felix at Comic Art, and I know that a lot of his previous work is analog. But was there a particular thing that made you suspect that maybe there's some digital work happening?
Yeah, for this issue, it's on that later page when the three Cobra characters blow up after the fight with Dawn. The way that the smoke is inked, and it's really subtle, and I can't explain it very well, but the lines of that smoke have the subtle lack of variety to me that says digital ink line, even if the brush has pressure sensitivity turned on, as opposed to the like infinitely changing and imperfect line of an actual pen or brush. And it's something that it's like, you know, like there are a couple artists who draw for Marvel and DC who like 5 years ago switched from paper to digital, and like the issue where it happened, very subtly I could tell. It's like, oh, there's a little less variation in the line weight. So that's what I thought I saw here. But I happily stand corrected. If Mooneyham's drawing G.I. Joe on paper, it's also possible he's doing both. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes an artist, like they're running out of time, and so they draw some pages a little smaller or digitally, or they'll like do all their thumbnails as pencils and then they'll ink digitally because it's just faster. All right, back to you. Let's talk about this comic.
Okay, so we're on Cobra Island next. We see some more evidence of the mutated hordes that are still there, milling about aimlessly, but at least not devouring each other. They want to step up to produce more enhanced blue ninjas, and talk about the logistics of doing that, of stripping out slot machines and so on. But interesting here as well, Serpentor Khan says as well that he wants to start a production line for more mutant virus bombs. I guess this is sort of laying, I guess, a little bit of storytelling optionality in the future, devices to spread the virus through aerosols. So then we're flicking back to Springfield, where Cobra Commander is being spied on by the Viper team as he's giving a rally. Again, second time we're seeing him sort of in that, very much in that leader position, giving a rally. Before it was to the citizens of Springfield, and now it's definitely to troopers. We've got lines of troops in the community center, Crimson Guard, Cobra Troopers, Crimson Guard Immortal, which is an interesting choice. We don't get to see too many of them. Hiss Drivers, Worms, the Maggot Drivers, and AVAC pilots. And this is very much a splash page where we see Cobra Commander with those troopers sort of laid out in panels behind him. And a slightly different look to Cobra Commander. He's kind of got this balaclava type hood to him, which I sort of wondered, looking at to myself, that if there's a kind of a ban of that traditional hooded look to Cobra Commander, you know, with all of the connotations of Ku Klux Klan hoods that Hasbro want to avoid, perhaps we've got a new look to Cobra Command, the hooded Cobra Commander that we might end up seeing a little bit more frequently.
Yeah, I thought the same thing. Movie producer Lorenzo Di Bonaventura, a couple years ago while making one of his G.I. Joe movies, said, you know, that costume looks like the KKK, right? And like in interviews, he's like, Hasbro didn't see it. And I said, it looks like that. And I think that got some attention. And so seemingly Hasbro has moved away from the hooded costume. I very much agree. If this is the compromise, it's great. It's different, but it also, if it's different, it feels safe. It feels safe. And it is also familiar. This whole scene, Cobra Commander's speech, I'm seeing Cobra Commander as the fascist dictator. Like, I think this scene's supposed to feel like a Nazi rally because there are these giant red banners in the background. And, you know, we all love the Cobra logo, you know, like Ron Rudat posts a photo on Facebook of the original artwork, you know, or people have that he designed, or people have T-shirts, or, you know, it's fun to put the sticker on the toy. In the same way that, you know, we like the Empire. We like the Empire's symbol from Star Wars. We like Darth Vader. But these are bad guys. They want to conquer us and end our freedom. And even though in fiction it's fun to root for them, it's like, no. In real life, Cobra Commander is a terrible, reprehensible person. And I don't want to be friends with any CGs. And then look at the rest of his costume, where he has the wide lapels and the epaulets and the sort of high belt from the harness, and then the sort of lower half of the coat that goes past his waist, and then I forget what it's called, but when the pants puff out on the sides, it's like he's supposed to look like a Nazi. And I think that's great because he's kind of a Nazi, and Nazis are bad. So in addition to the story stuff here, going back to the previous page when it's still Serpentorcon, before we cut to the speech, I was really surprised that he wants more mutant virus bombs, because I had expected, since Hama introduced that as such a funny sort of throwaway around issue 296, that it's like, well, you know, he's not going to carry on with that. That's going a step too far. And then, you know, it gets set off. And I thought, okay, well, you know, if he does more of this, he's shooting himself in the foot. So it's just going to be contained to Cobra Island. But Hama's giving some stakes for himself, and I think he's making Serpentorcon sort of even more dangerous and crazy. And so that Cobra Commander has such a strong defensive response, and, like, you know, a strong offense is the best defense response in his big speech. I was really taken by this scene. And then we get sort of a similar note after you turn the page after the speech, where the Night Creeper, the Alley Viper, and the Night Viper are agreeing that, you know, like they're going to get to the next step of their plan. And then Dawn says, whispering, we'll see about that, which sort of echoes the close up on Spirit's mouth where he says, where Joe feels like they have the slight upper hand against some villains. Mm. And then we cut back to sort of after the cleanup operation with Airtight and Mainframe and Black Hat. And, you know, so we're back to the Tomahawk. And the second panel on this page is one of these red knockouts. It's not technically a full knockout. A knockout is one color, but it's acting like a knockout because of the, as we know from issue 21, when Snake Eyes jumps out of the C-130, a night mission, the light that's on inside the aircraft is red. And I love this treatment here because everything is bathed in red, but there's not really any rendering or gradients going on. You know, the gun in the foreground on the left, it's just one red, and the inking does the rest. And you get just a little bit of sort of like a darker red and a lighter red on their heads, on their shirts, on their pants, and the whole background behind them is just these sort of two different reds. And then Hama gives them something to do and reminds us that the blue ninjas are really dangerous. And then it becomes an action scene. And I feel like in some ways, this is like the apex of the issue, because this really fast, high stakes fight happens all in 2.5 pages, and it's with a new Joe, a Joe we don't often see get to do anything, and you get the added bonus of Mainframe not only uses a pistol, but you can assume that it's the pistol that his action figure comes with, you know, and considering he doesn't get to do a lot, it's like he's not typing on his computer and he's not intercepting a call over like Cobra Airwaves. No, he's using his action figure accessory. And that's always a nice bit of like Joe, you know, toy fan celebration.
To be much more specific, Airtight is using his sniffer to whack one of these blue ninjas and trash it.
And then sort of in the same way that I was really happy with Mooneyham's storytelling on that earlier page around the three Quonset huts, you know, doing a fight inside a contained space like the Tomahawk is hard. And I think in terms of reminding us in every panel or continually and clearly just how little space there is to work with, I think Mooneyham gets a B here. But I'm also really flexible on this because this page has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 panels. And the previous page had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 panels. And even though I don't really lose the thread of sort of they're inside this helicopter, it's very small, it's moving through space, it's got an open door. He reminds us of the open door twice, and then Black Hat goes out of it. And even if on the final panel of this page where she yells, "Look out, Airtight!" and he says, "Black Hat!" Even though Mooneyham could have pulled the camera back a little further to sort of more clearly show that she's going out the door, there are some helpful context clues. One is all of the air or smoke that's sort of twirling around Black Hat and the Blue Ninja. And two, colorist Francesco Segala puts her and the Blue Ninja in blue, just as the rest of the Tomahawk interior and Airtight are in red. And so the color is showing you that she's now outside. And then the next panel, if you weren't clear, makes it very clear where, okay, he didn't have the room to pull back the camera far enough to show more of the helicopter, more of the door, more of her going out the door. Oh my gosh, she's gonna die. She's sacrificing herself. She grabs the thing and she jumps out. Right. But then the next page makes it really clear where we get a whole bunch of the helicopter. We get Airtight holding on to the doorway with one hand, holding on to Black Hat with the other, more of that smoke trailing out, and then in the distance, having let go the Blue Ninja. And then sort of the color sort of scripting for the scene continues, where there's a little bit of red light cast on the right side of Black Hat, and yet the rest of the exterior background is all blue. And then let's not forget, there are two Joes in the cockpit, and Hama gives us, you know, a G.I. Joe surprise, fun, badass moment where Wild Bill, who only ever gets to just take off and land and like check in with Duke. And I forget, didn't he crash like 30 issues ago? I can't remember. Wild Bill hasn't gotten to do much in a while. And that always makes me a little sad. Like, I'd love an issue where, you know, Wild Bill and Lift Ticket have to like climb a mountain or anyway. So, and not just does he do something cool that's not just piloting. He does it with a very particular weapon. And help me out, Mark. Is this pistol of his? Is this something that we've seen with a particular action figure? Is it molded onto the figure's leg?
No, the original Wild Bill didn't come with a pistol. When he came with the Dragonfly, he was re-released as a version 2 figure in the kind of the blue, more cavalry kind of look to him. And okay. I think he did have a pistol there, but I think this is sort of more, I think this is a cool pistol rather than a revolver rather than necessarily a...
Well, okay, so Airtight says that old hog leg still does the trick. And his Wild Bill's original 83 figure does have molded on to each leg.
Yes, indeed. Yeah.
And they have, and they're the handles are painted white. So these are, it's some
very
like
part
old,
of, yeah,
older fashioned, yeah, pistol, not like a, you know, army, and, Air Force pistol.
And hog leg. I looked that up. It is a term that is used to describe a large caliber long barrel revolver. I think was originally coined talking about a Bisley revolver, and it sounds like the word hog leg came about because the grip of the revolver resembles a porcine appendage. So looks like the shape of an actual hog leg. There's also a mare leg, which is slang for a cut down lever action rifle.
We can be more specific. The new classified 6-inch Wild Bill figure, those two pistols, I guess they're revolvers, right? Mm-hmm. So what was molded onto his legs in 83, and they are revolvers, they are separate items that he can hold in his hands with his 6-inch classified figure. So I don't know that Hama is calling out something from a classified figure the way that the Energon Universe comics are trying to reference the classified designs, but I do think Hama is being more specific with this toy, either version, classic or modern, than, you know, we sometimes forget that the Joes already have like a grenade and a pistol and a knife sort of stuck on them.
Yeah, yeah. I was being a little bit too literal in my interpretation of that V1. You're right that he did have the revolvers molded on. This little scene, though, sort of made me happy in some ways and in another. The happiness was in sort of being termed in terms of being proved right, because when they were loading all of these blue ninjas onto the helicopter originally, I thought, you know, hold on, are you definitely sure that these are all completely out of action? Because they're quite sophisticated bits of kit, and, you know, you don't want them to sort of come back online and cause some horrible damage. So I was kind of glad that had been thought about and that did come to pass, but sad in terms of the G.I. Joe experts not actually thinking about that themselves. But there we go.
Is it okay? So I feel like somewhere after, you know, issue 230, 250, 260, there'd be an info packet sent to every Joe, or an actual like slideshow talk at the pit. It's like, okay, some of us fought these new AI ninjas, and they're robots, and they dress in blue, and they've got this hive mentality, and you have to shoot them in the head, and also sometimes they play dead. So I feel like every Joe should know. But yes, for the sake of giving these Joes something exciting and heroic to do, putting them in danger, if they need to act a little uncharacteristically carelessly in an earlier scene so that they can be a little more exciting, it can be a little more exciting in this scene, I'll take it. Then we get this cool fight. Then we get the real closure. That the cover suggested and perhaps promised, which is Dawn Marino versus Night Creeper, Night Viper, Alley Viper. And it's a 4-page scene. And so whereas I said a few minutes ago, the previous scene in the Tomahawk was sort of the action apex of the scene, you get a second action scene right after it, and it's very different. The other one was contained in a helicopter and was more about pistols. And this one is on a rooftop, and it's got swords and a grappling hook and an arrow. So it's more like a ninja scene. So how do you take this scene, Mark?
I think generally it was kind of quite a just cool action scene. Yeah, yeah. Sort of like you say, delivering on what the cover promises. Yeah, just quite an exciting action scene and a nice finale to the issue.
We have seen Dawn get to do some cool fighting in the last 70 or 60 issues. But it does feel like it's been a little while since it's been her solo. Mm-hmm. So in that regard, this was cool. Also, a couple times recently when we saw her, she was sort of confused or a little torn up because she's got these implanted memories or, you know, throwdowns nearby. And this is just her. This is just solo. There's a slight change that Mooneyham is making to the Alley Viper's outer helmet, the sort of face shield, the part that pushes up and slides down into place, where here the Alley Viper has seemingly a night vision scope on the helmet the way that the Night Viper does, as opposed to a like imprinted Cobra logo. And I'll accept it.
Yeah, I think that's picking up a little bit on a classified addition to the design where there's that sort of circular component on the front of the design.
Well, readers of my blog may remember that I've been going back and forth on actually buying an Alley Viper classified figure, and I don't have one in hand. So that is the kind of detail that might pass me by.
And the other element is obviously that the mask has been colored blue, which isn't, you know, completely canonical, but does make for, you know, an interesting sort of contrasting change to,
yes,
so that it makes the mask pop a little bit more on
exactly
the panel.
Whether that is a choice or a mistake, I think it's totally fine. I'll allow it. Okay, so Sagala does something, colorist Sagala does something subtle here. We're on this first page with the square panels and the like the thermal view of Dawn that's all in magenta, and then the three Cobras throwing their weapons. That page, those first three panels, the three Cobra agents on the rooftop are colored normally. Once the actual fight starts on the next page, Dawn's running at us. The three weapons that the Cobras have thrown, now they're knocked out in red. And now the scene gets a red cast. So the three backgrounds behind Dawn as she dodges and parries, right? Zwish, ka-chang, chuck. Those backgrounds are red, but it's like light red, middle red, saturated red. And then the bottom three panels where she disarms each of them, those three Cobras, it's no longer the sort of local color of like purple under moonlight, green under moonlight. It's purple, green, and Alley Viper orange with a red cast. And this is something that Sagala has been doing this whole run, which I really like, which is that every scene gets its own set of colors, you know, and this has been consistent. So every time we cut back to Serpentor, Mindbender, and Alpha 001, whether they're inside or outside, they are green and purple. Those scenes are green and purple. The backgrounds are subtly green and purple, right? And then throughout this issue, every scene change gets a slightly different color cast. And it's just a small thing that Sagala can do to create some visual interest, separate one scene from another, and show some chops. And it happens in this final scene as well. It's also a way to add interest in a somewhat conservative color approach, or maybe I should say restrained, because Sagala is not doing a lot of rendering and a lot of his colors are desaturated. And yet in this scene, when the red happens, it's really punchy, right? And it sort of peaks in the final panel just before the three Cobras self-destruct, where she says, come on, let's see what else you've got. And there's this, Mooneyham is inking her as if there's a bright light right above her. And maybe it's the moon, or maybe it's some random, you know, high street light or security light in Springfield or on this building. It doesn't matter what it is, because she's almost without color, right? This light is so high key that her flesh tone highlights are white, and her flesh tone sort of shadow areas are her normal complexion, the undersides of her arms. And then Sagala just drops in a dark but pure red knockout behind her, right? To sort of just add color emphasis. And this is much more the way that comics were colored in the 60s and 70s. And then they blow up. And give us your thoughts, Mark, on the end of this fight and then the final page of this comic.
Yeah, I'll take the how it resolves that they've exploded each other, and it sort of brings it to a tidy conclusion. She says, Duke, I think I found their fatal flaw. I don't know exactly what that is, that if they look like they're going to lose, then they'll blow themselves up. I don't know. Maybe she spotted something that I haven't.
I think that's what it is. We cannot allow our technology to fall into the hands of the Joes. So they just, all the Joes need to threaten to handcuff all the zombies.
Yeah. Threaten them, and then they'll just blow the whole lot themselves up. And then so I think it's good that we've got these couple of sort of punchy action scenes, and we're sort of concluding on one of them. And then there's a one page sort of taster for what I guess, what is to come, because we've got not got enough we've not got enough sort of plot machinations in progress. Let's add in one into the mix, and this time it's a return to Destro's castle in Scotland, where he's on a throne with Baroness next to him, still wearing a Cobra logo though, and a visit from Zartan. So Zartan obviously clued in to the events and looking to team up with Destro. But I think, you know, the lead Cobra characters throughout the IDW run, it has kind of, you know, reinforced that it is Cobra Commander, Mindbender, Destro, Baroness, Zartan, first and foremost, with you know, the odd other extras here and there. So it is good to see them come back into the mix. And Zartan's sort of plot art recently has been a little bit directionless to some degree, that he's sort of been on the side of the G.I. Joes, and both Destro and Zartan helped out the Joes in Springfield in the Snake Hunt arc, which was where we last saw a lot of them. You know, they very much turned their backs on Cobra and joined the Joes in terms of, you know, out and out killing Cobras on the streets of Springfield. So
can you be a little more specific for our listeners? So we haven't seen Destro, Baroness, and Zartan since what, around 275?
Yeah, so Snake Hunt concluded in 275, and that had the Joes, Destro, and Zartan departing Springfield and leaving a fairly bloody wake behind them. And yeah, we've not really seen any significant... we haven't seen Destro or Zartan in any significant way since then, because we had some untold tales. We then had Murder by Assassination, which was sort of very much focused on these new characters. And then we had the Cobra Casino plots, you know, focused on Cobra Island, without them being involved in that particular plot. So yeah, it has been some fairly significant amount of time where these key players haven't been part of the main story.
Yeah, I have been wondering when we would see Destro and Zartan in the Skybound run from Hama. I'm glad it's now. I mean, the speaking of 206 getting a fill-in artist, right? The preview pages show Zartan. So just before I read this new issue and there's Zartan, I thought, well, Zartan's coming up at least in two more issues. But I think this is I don't know where this is going. I think this is neat to have these three characters teaming up if they're all on the outs with Cobra Commander. Hopefully Hama has had them out of circulation for long enough that he's got something cool for them to do. I do feel like I don't remember having a strong reaction, positively or negative, to what Zartan was last up to. I do remember feeling like Destro and the Baroness in not the Untold Tales or the Special Missions issues, but Artificial Intelligence, you know, with the Blue Ninjas. I feel like that sort of it wasn't quite as interesting as I hoped. So now that there's been a break, I look forward to them being awesome. I just wanted to go back two pages and point out two more things about the fight between Dawn and these three Cobras. One is that she slashes the Alley Viper's shield in half, which is cool, but I don't know if it can do that. And, you know, I think about like lightsabers and Wolverine's claws, and, you know, it's like these can cut through anything. So I don't know what I forget if Dawn has a particular sword, how amazing it is. I'll allow it just because it's a cool moment. But I did think, wait a minute, that's not realistic. And then the next page where on the top, with a very striking white background, no color. Right. And that's a choice. The Alley Viper's in the distance. The Night Creeper is rushing with both bladed weapons while Dawn is pushing her sword behind her over her head to block the Night Viper, who has picked up a sword. And then she slashes a particular way and then she kicks them. And I think of this scene and I think, okay, Hama's plotting for this page must have been quite specific. And maybe he did some thumbnails, because he's been known to do that for if he wanted an artist to not flub a particular sort of martial arts fight scene. But I'm sort of imagining that Mooneyham got it right here, that the plot called for some very specific sort of poses and positions and beats. And even though this is only three panels, you know, it's like the way that the Night Creeper is holding one sword and another dagger, or that one is in his left hand and one is in his right hand, or that he's close enough to be a threat in that first panel but hasn't yet started to slash or swing. This is the kind of thing that I can see Hama being specific about in his plotting. And, you know, once or twice on Facebook in the last couple of years, he has pointed out where an artist didn't capture a fight scene as specifically as he wanted, to his disappointment. And so I don't know that Mooneyham definitely got this, or kind of got this, or didn't get this. But this scene was clear to me. It was exciting. And I think I can see through it Hama calling for something specific, and I think Mooneyham getting it, which is very cool.
Yeah. And yeah, you mentioned as well the Night Viper having a sword that Dawn is blocking when she's holding the sword sort of over her shoulders and covering her back. It's not really obvious where that sword has come from, and the Night Viper isn't really established as a character that would necessarily have a sword. But, you know, it's a sneaky reconnaissance mission. He can have a sword.
I sort of thought he picked up someone's sword, but Dawn's other sword is sheathed.
Yeah.
And how many swords does the Night Creeper? I mean, did we just disprove everything I just said? Did Hama's plot call for something specific about this other sword and like how the Night Viper comes to be using it, and Mooneyham didn't draw that? Or did the plot not call necessarily for the Night Viper to have a sword, and Mooneyham thinks, I'm going to have him pick up this sword, because a page earlier, he seems to be dropping his weapon, or it's getting cut in half. And then there's four pages of letters, and listeners, when I write my email about this issue, I'm going to say, I love it that the letters page is four pages long. Not one, like Marvel, Postbox the Pit, and some IDW Postbox the Pit. Not two, like some IDW Postbox the Pit and a bunch of DC books in the 80s and 90s. But four! That's a lot of letters that get included. And I don't know, how many there are? Six? Five out of six of them are positive. Which is, I'm guessing, like a nice sort of proper ratio for, you know, what they're getting in their inbox. But even though five of them are positive, there's some good variety. And someone even calls out that the IDW run at the end didn't have a letters page. And so not only am I going to say in my email, I'm really psyched that you have a four-page letters page. I hope you can keep that up. And, you know, if you've got like two pages of sketches from Mooneyham, or if you want to give us an extra page or two of comics, I will never argue with that. But we feel, if you read the letters in a comic, you hopefully feel a little part of the community of readers, even if, I don't know, everyone's writing, if you agree with, even if you don't feel like you have anything to say. And like, yes, we have podcasts and discussion boards and Twitter and all that stuff. So you can express your opinions to the people who make this comic and your friends and other fans that you don't know quite easily and instantly, much faster than this printed comic, where, you know, you got like a 1 in 20 or a 1 in 500 chance of getting your letter printed, Mark. But when it's actually in the issue, it's now not part of the canon of the story, but part of the canon of publication. You know, I'm really excited that I've in my life had like five or six letters published, Mark, and there's so, I feel so much relief that G.I. Joe by Hama is back, that it's being done really well and carefully, that a lot of people are showing up for it, and most of them seem to really like it. And so that there is a letters page, particularly when the final year, oh, IDW, didn't have one, and that it's so long. Like, let's just not bask in it. Let's all hang out in this room for a little while longer and talk about this. And, you know, like Spawn and Cerebus and Savage Dragon, there's some comics, or Walking Dead, there's some comics out there that sort of famously have like long letters pages, 3 pages, 4 pages, 5 pages. Dave Sim published entire books of his letters that he didn't fit into the monthly Cerebus. I really liked this letters page. Even though I was disappointed my letter didn't get printed. But, Mark...
Yeah, Tim, let's read out the best letter from this letter page. Shall I read it?
Yes.
Okay.
Why don't you read it as if there are no typos? And then to complete the loop, we've already called out one typo in this issue. This issue has three. After you read your letter as if there are no typos, I'll just point out the two typos. And then we can talk about your letter.
Dear Postbox the Pit, I host the G.I. Joe Comics podcast, where we not only talk at length about G.I. Joe comics, but also to the creators of the comics, so you could say that I love G.I. Joe comics. I've been on the edge of my seat for a year waiting to find out what will happen to the Joes in that C-130. What Serpentor Khan will get up to with that zombie bomb? What is up with the newly clones, Snake Eyes, and more besides? Like, will we find out the secret of Sherlock's connection to Alcobra? And will we ever find out what sleeping laundry is? And all the rest of the dangling plot threads. So 301 was eagerly anticipated. You are off to a great start with 301, beyond the continuation of the ongoing story that I am enjoying so much. Chris Mooneyham's art is an exciting and intense take, with fascinating design choices that make this book feel very different to the previous era, particularly when combined with the retro meets modern colours from Francesco Segala, who frequently makes bold and dynamic choices. And Andy Kubert back on covers is a stamp of quality right from the off and puts us in mind of the classic Marvel era. Here are a few suggestions from me. Cover A that reflects the story inside. You're off to a great start. Maybe even a splash page with story title and credits on page one. Digging deeper into the Cobra cast of characters, maybe introducing some new Cobras that have never been seen in the comics, like Tombstone. Looking forward to the future of Joe with characters like Sherlock, but also linking to the past. Untold Tales, for example. Let's see the best of new artists, but also revisit legends like Rod Wiggum or Ron Wagner. My favourite recent work from Larry Hama was on Spy Hunter and Paperboy with Mac Ray. I would love to see Mac Ray take a spin in the world of G.I. Joe. Double-sized issues, specials, miniseries, yearbooks, more Joe. All that said, Larry Hama never quite gives us what we expect, and it's always a blast for it, following where we will be taken next. It's an exciting time to be a G.I. Joe comics fan. Yo, Joe. Mark, Talking Joe, Seddon, Talking Joe Podcast.
And then editor Alex Antone replies, Yo, Mark, these are all excellent suggestions. We've got lots of fun A-Ross stuff planned, some of which may or may not be above. We'll keep you guessing. But we do listen to what fans want as well. So, thanks so much for the input. Congratulations, Mark, on getting a letter printed. Remind us, is this your second letter in G.I. Joe Real American Era?
It is my second, yes.
Okay, you had one in IDW.
That's right, yeah. Where I suggested things like a return to Cobra Island, which happened not too long afterwards.
Mm.
I just looked up my original email. And the typo is my own.
Oh, no.
The newly clones Snake Eyes. I'm owning it. The typo is my own.
Well, in your first sentence, when you said, I host the G.I. Joe Comics podcast, did you include the name of our podcast? I host the Talking Joe.
Oh, my God. Podcast. What an idiot. That's a typo of my own as well.
Oh,
but,
no.
But it is corrected, at least in the signature.
Yeah, twice as a nickname.
Yeah.
all right. Well, that's a bummer. My apologies from the beginning of the episode if I was giving Skybound a hard time. Skybound, one of the three typos in this issue is on you. Two of them are on my podcast partner.
I sent this on November the 16th.
Oh, that's a while ago. All right, so we're in February now, January, December. So had you only read 301, 302
yeah.
hadn't come out yet?
I'm just looking up Diamond.
Wow.
So the release date of 301 was November the 15th. So this was sent the day after release. So it'd be the Wednesday. The comic would have come out on Wednesday the 15th. My letter was sent November the 16th. And part of the thinking was that I thought the sooner I would send a letter in, the more likely that they would be able to receive that and put it into the letter column in time. So I guess there'd be a whole bunch of letters in reaction that would have been coming too late for them to print. But also I guess they like to get ahead of these things as well, so that they would begin compiling their letters pages sort of some way ahead.
Yeah, I have always assumed abstractly that, you know, issue one of a comic comes out, and sometimes in the olden days, the publisher would send previews to a few readers whose addresses they had, so they could have letters in the first issue or maybe even the second issue. But generally, the timeline is in the first two issues, the editors say, hey, we're going to have a letters page, get in your letters. And then with the third issue, letters about the first issue run. And so there's, let's say, a 2-month delay. And I've always kind of assumed that by this same timeline, if you send a letter or an email about the first issue, but you don't send it until sort of the 4th month, they're not going to run it because they're trying to keep their letters that they are printing as recent, as topical yeah. as possible. So if in issue 7, they're running letters about issue 5, if you've got a letter that's about issues 1 through 5, you might get in. But if you're really just talking about issue 1 or 2, you're sort of disqualified. And that your letter shows up here suggests otherwise. I think it's very possible that they're still just coming through letters from the first month or two. Or maybe every month they cull some letters and they think, all right, it's going to be 2 or 3 or 4 out of these 10. And then maybe with this issue, it's like, why don't we run, you know, we don't have any backup pages or sketch pages. Let's run 2 more pages of letters pages. Oh, there was that letter from November that we like flagged in our inbox. That was a good letter. Let's run that. And folks, one of my employees at my store in the 80s would, on New Comics Day, read a bunch of books and then immediately that afternoon on postcards respond to each one. And postcards specifically, so he was limited in how much he could write. You know, if you write a really, really, really long letter, they're either not going to run it or they're going to run a section of it. And sometimes they'll say, like, you know, sorry, we had to cut your letter short. We take all your comments. We want to include this part. Thanks. And whenever I've written a letter to a comic, I always think, this is too long. They're not going to run this, even if it's sort of medium length. And I'll say, the letter that I sent a month ago after 303, I wrote everything that I wanted to, and I thought, this is too long. And then I copied it and pasted and edited it by 1/3. So in the email, I actually sent 2 versions, and both of them I marked okay to print. And I, at the bottom, I wrote, if that's too long, here's a shorter version. I thought, crossing my fingers, maybe they'll run that one. It doesn't make all the points, but it gets across the main stuff. Anyway, I found myself both happy for you, also happy for us, and agreeing with all of your points and glad that you made them because, you know, yes, I mean, everyone, let's not forget, if you're tuning into Talking Joe recently because of the return at Skybound, you might have missed our episode on Spy Hunter and Paperboy, where Mac Ray said, man, I would love to work with Larry Hama again. And didn't he say specifically to us, you know, like a flashback story.
Like a Vietnam flashback or something.
Yeah. And if you read The Mercenary Sea that Mac Ray drew, man, he'd be a good fit for a Vietnam flashback G.I. Joe story. I think every suggestion you made, I agreed with. I also appreciated that you sort of hit a lot of the right notes. Your letter's not too long. You reminded them of some things that they may have forgotten about, like Alcabra, sleeping laundry. You pointed to some specifics, like Chris Moodyham's art and Francesco Scala's colors. And your requests are all requests that I have had, like some new characters like Tombstone and, you know, some returning artists like Rod Wiggum and Ron Wagner. And so, listeners, even if you, particularly if you send a 2-sentence email, they will definitely read that. I think editors, depending on how busy they are on a day or in the cycle of a month, I think they're really happy to get letters, emails from readers, because that is a very different kind of communication than reviews or podcasts or like video, you know, streams where someone talks about a comic. If someone is taking the time to specifically communicate with the editorial team and with, you know, the writer and artist, that's direct, as opposed to like, I've got stuff to say about G.I. Joe. Everyone come and listen to my podcast. Come to my blog. And at the same time, I think editors are sometimes, while happy to get letters, you know, they're always sort of behind schedule. They're juggling a bunch of things. They're putting together a bunch of other books. They've got all these people and assets to deal with. And, oh, right, we have to put together the letters page, which is why comics have assistant editors and assistant editors. You know, if everyone who reads this book writes in a letter and says, like, get Ron Wagner back, I don't know that that would do it for sure. But they would hear that in a way that is very different than if no one emailed Skybound and said, get Ron Wagner back. So, you know, listeners, if you have requests, if you have things that you like and things that you want changed, do send an email to arah@skybound.com.
Very good. Yeah, interestingly, the voice of the response is currently Alex Antoni rather than necessarily Larry Hammer. So hopefully Larry is seeing some of this as well.
Then there's an ad for Renegades Transformers games and an ad for Renegades G.I. Joe games. And mm-hmm. I have played and liked the G.I. Joe deck building game, and I have played and like G.I. Joe Mission Critical, which is a miniatures card tabletop game. And I own but have not played the role-playing game. But I was a little worried that these things had sort of launched a year ago and gotten some supplements and were starting to fizzle out, and that might be happening. But it's a nice little sign that they both the Transformers products from Renegade Game Studios and the Joe ones get ads in the back of this book. It feels like the right kind of synergy, you know? It's a G.I. Joe comic. You have a captive audience. Certainly Skybound wants to promote some of its own stuff, some other related comics, you know, the Invincible show on Amazon. But Joe stuff.
Quote of the week, quote of the week, quote of the week, quote of the week,
quote of the week, quote of the week,
quote of the week.
I had a favorite line of dialogue from this book, Tim. It was from Cobra Commander's speech. I quite often pick out Cobra Commander as my favorite line of dialogue. Cobra is facing an existential crisis. A vile usurper and a traitorous tooth yanker are conspiring with a depraved, weaponized AI hive mind to engineer our downfall. Within that, my favorite bit is the traitorous tooth yanker. Of course, Dr. Mindbender being a former dentist tooth yanker.
I don't have a favorite line, but not for any bad reasons.
It's Yo, Joe-age time.
Let's do a score. We've talked at length about it. I think mine is a very solid 7.5. It looks good. The art's great. The colouring's great. There's a lot of things going on in here, sort of moving everything along. But there wasn't a particular standout thing for me that sort of made it one of the all-timers. So very good, but out of the four so far, it's in the pack. Tim.
Maybe an 8, you know, from the cover, from so much happening, storytelling, the visual storytelling, taking a turn for the improved, a cool return of some characters. You got a letter printed.
Actually, yeah, that'll give it an extra point. Maybe I should turn mine into an 8. It's got my own darn letter in it. 8, yeah.
I take your point about, how did you just phrase it? Sort of like the biggest stuff ever doesn't happen in it in terms of standout moments, but it's a series of really strong moments, and there are no weak or sort of filler or tepid scenes here. There's a lot of tension. There's a lot of rising tension in this issue. So I think an 8. This is one of those covers. Andy Kubert does not sell his originals, right? If you look online, you see almost none. And this is one of those covers where I've thought, huh, that'd be really fun to own.
Very good. Next time on Talking Joe, we will be covering the latest issue of ARA as it comes out. 305 is due out on March the 20th as the Skybound era of ARA continues. We will be covering Duke 2 and 3 together, and then Cobra Commander 2 and 3 together. And we will also be continuing to look back on the Devil's Due era, as well as more besides, such as our recent interview with Hasbro's Michael Kelly. You can find us at the normal places. The normal places are linked to from talkingjoe.co.uk, which is the website. We're on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. You can leave us a voicemail by scrolling down to the bottom of talkingjoe.co.uk if you want to contribute on air. We are also on Patreon, patreon.com/talkingjoe. And a big thanks to our backers, as always, who include Richard, Sam, Jay, Bill, Christopher, Justin, Rob, Brian, Shane, Ryan, and Simon, who are all getting early access to episodes as well as some exclusive content. Tim, where can people find you when you are not talking to me about all things JoJo?
With my creative partners, we have a YouTube channel at Atomic Abe, which is video essays on TV and film. My brick and mortar comic book store in Somerville, Massachusetts is Hub Comics. And I write about G.I. Joe at my blog, arealamericanbook.com.
Very good. And I think with that, that is us done. But remember that...
nobody beats Talking Joe, an international podcast!
Laters.
Man, this cover is so great.